The Dialogue Conspiracy with Mae Brussel. For the past 14 years, Mae has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to political conspiracies. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel. This is Carmel, California, August the 29th, and it's Dialogue Conspiracy number 284. There were two items in the news just before I came on the air that I want to repeat in case you get this program and do not have the opportunity to hear the KLRB news. They're important accounts of J. Edgar Hoover's links to Nazi Germany. And I believe that as more time goes on, you'll see the top officials and the corporations having a role in putting Adolf Hitler into power. And that basically is what I'm going to be talking about for the entire program of Dialogue Conspiracy today. So I want to include these two news releases or start off with them. The first is a Zodiac press release that a private research organization sponsored by the Church of Scientology has been charging that the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover maintained a close and secret relationship with top Nazi police officials in Germany until the very outbreak of World War II. The Scientologists have obtained 1,785 pages of secret FBI documents about the correspondence of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI with the German police, both before the war broke out and after the war. Among the documents released are a number of friendly letters between J. Edgar Hoover and the Berlin police officials, many of them written between 1939 and 1941, after the Nazi invasion of Poland and even the fall of France to Hitler's troops. One letter has J. Edgar Hoover's signature, written in September 1939. That was the month of the invasion of Poland. It was written 2 weeks after the Germans had invaded Poland, indicating that J. Edgar Hoover was sending autographed pictures of himself to the international police force leaders in Berlin. According to the National Commission, similar FBI correspondence to Berlin continued until December of 1941. That was the time of Pearl Harbor, because then it would be embarrassing to the Bureau to have our FBI chief corresponding with the Nazis. The commission says the memos show that Hoover finally agreed to cut off his correspondence with Berlin officials December 4, 1941, more than a year after much of Europe had fallen to the Nazis and 3 days before the attack on Pearl Harbor. There's another item of Earth news, that was Zodiac news, that Hoover cooperated during World War II with the Nazis, in addition to the 3 days before Pearl Harbor. In handwriting, he had contact to top Nazi officials at just prior to when we entered the war, and he also had contact, of course, with them as soon as the war was over through the organization known as Interpol. One of Hoover's letters was addressed to Arthur Neebe, N-E-B-E, chief of the German criminal police, who headed a mobile unit that traveled behind the Allied lines to murder Jews. Neebe was one of the first Nazis to suggest that Jews imprisoned in concentration camps be used as guinea pigs in medical experiments. This was in the news just this week. Another letter shows that Hoover sent an autographed photo of himself to a second Nazi officer who admired Hoover's work, and this picture of J. Edgar Hoover hung in the Nazi headquarters along with other top law enforcement officers, and the Nazi officials had collected and placed them there. This is important because the American financiers that put J. Edgar Hoover into office in the FBI also had put Adolf Hitler into the position of power in Germany, hoping that he would conquer the Soviet Union. And this was the goal, to conquer Russia. And I'm sure that J. Edgar Hoover considered them great anti-communists and heroes in his eyes. And as soon as the war was over, the list of people to be exterminated in Germany that were not yet exterminated when the Allies landed were put in the hands of Interpol. That's the International Police Organization. And it was in Austria. And then their files were taken to Brussels, and J. Edgar Hoover then became the vice president of Interpol. He continued his contact with the Nazis when World War II is over, and the data banks and the information were put in Brussels. And it's that information that I am fearful about that ends up in the genealogical records at the Latter-day Saints Church in Salt Lake City. I fear that J. Edgar Hoover has worked with the Nazis before the war and after the war, and more documents will be coming out of the role of Charles Lindbergh, Richard Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, and Howard Hughes, and the Rockefeller family, Ford family, the financiers, the Mellons, the DuPonts, the manufacturers of weapons, and certainly the oil financiers, worked with the Nazis. ITT worked with the Nazis. And they were very sorry that Adolf Hitler lost the war and brought these people out of Germany and into the United States and into Shanghai and South America and all over the entire world, Africa, wherever they could settle them, and gave them a lot of money to start what I think is the Fourth Reich. And it's a very depressing subject to me. As a matter of fact, when I came to the station, I had prepared a list of topics that borders on this that I haven't talked for a long time with you about, because we've had other subjects that I've concentrated on. But the news is so dismal, and I see the Nazification of planet Earth. I think it was Hitler's goal. And I see every day piles of articles that are convincing me that the plans that Martin Bormann made and were carried out in the name of Adolf Hitler are working. I don't mean to be gloomy, and I certainly didn't mean to pick up these two items when I came in, but the subject of the medical experimentations that were done in Germany with this friend of J. Edgar Hoover's is consistent with the allegations of people now from the CIA documents. They're not allegations, they've been proven and documented, that starting in 1947, the CIA, and along with the FBI, they had the collusion of these agencies, wanted to alter human behavior, and they went and selected segments of our society as their guinea pigs for medical experiments. And the only difference now is that we don't have barbed wire and we don't put people in concentration camps. We have prisons in America that are like concentration camps, but the experiments can be happening to lawyers, doctors, witnesses to trial, persons that are involved in political assassinations, and the breadth of the experimentations has continued since World War II in the United States, certainly around the world, but particularly in the United States. And it's a very serious problem. It's one that bothers me all of the time. And the files that I have on death, mysterious deaths, motiveless crimes, just keeps growing way out of proportion to any other kind of news. I will be doing another show at length on Elvis Presley, and you know how I feel about the killing of all the rock and roll musicians in the era of the 60s or 70s. And again, I title it under the Nazification of America, getting rid of people that look different, dance different, put grease on their hair and make a dope tail, or sing moving their pelvis. In the case of Elvis Presley, his biggest crime, it seemed in the beginning, was that his life was always in danger, because when he danced with so much feeling and motion, or sang with so much feeling and motion, that the men who were out with dates were very jealous. The women would run to Elvis because he brought out something in them that the waspy rednecks couldn't do. And they were always fighting with Elvis, and Elvis had to have a team of bodyguards around him to protect his life. And I'm studying, I've spent the last week, part of the week, reading a book, which we'll go into detail later, called Elvis, What Happened? And it's a new book that came out by Red West, Sonny West, and Dave Hebler. It came out the day that Elvis Presley died, and Rhoda Barrett on the Good Morning Show was talking about Elvis being filled with drugs, even though the autopsy showed no drugs in his system of any kind. On the media, he was discredited immediately as being a fat slob consumed in messy drugs and violence. And I wanted to read the story. It's published by Ballantine. As I say, it just came out. And as I read the book, I came to the same pattern that always shows up in the research of every rock star or every person who's drugged, whether it's Howard Hughes or Candy Jones, and the pattern of bringing down certain segments of our society is so apparent even in this book. On page 114 in this book, Elvis, What Happened?, it tells the turning point in Elvis's life. He was a very religious boy. He was very fond of his parents and devoted. He didn't chase around with a lot of women. He was interested in women, but he wasn't promiscuous. He had a lot of talent and a lot of charisma, and he had a lot of beliefs in holistic healing and was very spiritual. And he was very popular. He could turn people on to listen to him. He was a good artist. And he went into the army, and until that time, he had a very consistent personality with the Elvis Presley that was young. And then he comes to Hollywood, and something strange happens in Hollywood. The first movie, Love Me Tender, started in April 1957. And that's when Elvis began working for RCA Victor. But the book goes on and says, in Elvis's third movie in 1957, Jailhouse Rock marked the first gradual change in his personality. They were changes that would bring him endless hours of suffering. And 1957 was the year that Howard Hughes began to be totally out of view of the public. Zonk threw his head with the drugs. 1957 was when Candy Jones, the model who was working for the Conover agency that Gerald Ford had worked for, was given drugs and sodium pentothal and had this personality change and turned into doubles. 1957 is a turning point in drug experimentation and application. The book goes on to say the pills began to do all the work for him. He was a walking pharmaceutical shop. He smoked some marijuana, but he didn't like it. He took uppers and downers, painkillers, Percodan, which they give to terminal cancer patients. Now, that's interesting because I will at length probably next week go into the new documents being declassified from for John Marks from the CIA, the drug experimentation. And one of their big centers was at Georgetown University in cancer and cancer experimentation, which I'm sure could both cause cancer, and then they had experiments in ending terminal patients, how to make them die. There was a headquarter for the CIA on just cancer and how to aid these in, it was at McGill College in Montreal, working on terminal cancer patients. It's interesting that they started feeding Elvis Presley, who's strong, good-looking, talented, Percodan. Here's the king of rock, who a lot of people were feared of because the pelvis was moving too hard and the girls were panting too hard and the country was going to go to the devil. So all of a sudden he was getting Percodan, which is what they give terminal cancer patients. He got prescriptions in the name of a lot of the boys around him, and many times he had to have a doctor with him. And then the book goes on to say, this doctor who made up his prescriptions has since vanished. Now, doesn't that remind you of the references I made on other programs to Robert Hall, the supplier of the drugs for Howard Hughes, the pharmacy he had in Hollywood, the drugs that came for people like Freddie Prinze up at Nevada, these unnamed doctors who take a powder, the Howard Hughes doctors that never appear or testify about the illegal drugs that were given to this person who was zonked out for 20 years. Well, Elvis began to get these drugs, and then the people who were around him had to leave. Dave Hibbler and Red West, Sonny West, couldn't stand being around him. He had this drastic personality change. He became suicidal, which, again, was one of the goals of the CIA experimentation. These men had promised his mother they would always protect him and be his bodyguard. They sincerely liked him. They were forced to leave him so that another team surrounded Elvis Presley. They went on in their book and wrote, I don't understand how anybody can deliberately set about to do himself in. Here's a guy who's one of the most popular persons in the world. He could have anything he wants. He had the means. He had fantastic physical specimen. It's hard to understand how he deliberately set out to destroy himself. Now, the question is, did he deliberately, or was he given this surreptitious food, this surreptitious acid, and these drugs, these terminal cancer drugs? Who surrounded Elvis? The book tells you a little bit about his first making money on records, and he moved in a neighborhood, and the family wasn't too welcome. Evidently, they weren't high class enough for this selected area. And Elvis had a lot of enemies. He was big money for some people, but he had people that were really threatened by unleashing these waspy emotions and bringing the sounds of black people into a white body and gyrating into some soul, or waking up youth to feelings. Our feelings are dormant and they're dead. People are becoming walking zombies, and it was a crime, a literal crime, to bring out these feelings. Elvis, according to this book, was a fascinating person, a fascinating human, but all of a sudden he changed so you wouldn't know him from one minute to the other, whether he'd get a gun at somebody or want to kiss them. They said they struggled with the changeability of his personality, which, again, is typical of the experiments of the CIA. These men said he took various pills. They took a toll on him and his personality. He had highs and lows. First, he would never get any sleep, and then there'd be coffee. And after a while, he got stronger pills like Desbutol and Escitrol, and then Valiums, and stronger, and then finally they gave him Placidil, which knocks you for a loop, and this would leave him, you know, just stiff and almost dead. And he struggled with this kind of medication. They said they'd give him medicine or pills that would bring out sweat. Again, a typical goal of the LSD drug testing program. And Elvis was madly in love with one woman, Priscilla. He had a child by her. And then in 1972, she was forced to leave him, and it broke his heart. And the removing of somebody you love in all of these cases is a typical pattern of breaking a person down, taking away the person that they are attached to. In the case of Madame New, who was talking about the CIA killing her husband, her daughter was killed in an automobile crash, and Madame New went into a convent, and we've never heard from her, for it's been many years since she ever uttered a public word. Aristotle Onassis had his son killed in a plane crash. Onassis became a shell of a person and never uttered another word. In the case of Howard Hughes, or the double of Howard Hughes, they took away all women in his life, where he was very heterosexual and liked sex and liked women. And all women were removed, and allegedly Gene Peters, whoever was with that entourage, whether it was the double, Vance Cooper, or used, I believe it was Vance Cooper, whether a female was with him, was removed totally, and they never saw a female. And these men have gone bananas and suicidal. Priscilla left him for Mike Stone, and then he was surrounded by what they called the Memphis Mafia. It's an interesting book on Elvis Presley. The dates fit the dates of these other people being drugged and tested and in the control, and certainly by age 42, he's dead. And as soon as he died, the media began to smear him for being totally drunk, drugged, and the autopsy didn't prove that at all, but he was killed. I believe he was killed. And rock and roll is going to be wound up with the big bands returning and kids doing the dances from the 40s and 50s. Or hopefully, this is what the establishment would like, to get back to those nice, clean, good old days that we hear about so much. I think it's a tragedy to do this medical experimentation. I think it's a legacy that J. Edgar Hoover and the Nazis brought to this country. And I think the end result is in the news everywhere I see it. And this isn't a very happy program, as I say, but I see it so many places. The Washington Post this last week, August 22nd, has an article by Maurice Flagg called "Empty Minds, Empty Lives, Can They Be Filled?" And it goes into the people of the United States and institutions and millions of us living purposeless lives. It goes on to the story of the looters in New York City and how they went out for kicks, but goes into the subject of what else is there to do for anyone. Forget the looters. What are we who are not looting doing? And it brings up, as I say, the millions of us unoccupied people, a nation we have become of shipwrecked people, unemployed, black, Hispanic neighborhoods. Every major city has these people in great number and doesn't know what to do with them. They are not only empty lives among us, but hundreds of thousands of old folks whiling out their days in nursing homes, retirement communities, second-story flats on back streets, children being put in foster agencies, discarded mates, the in-and-out population of public hospitals that have the human detriment lying around, unused shoals of American life, countless inventories of human wastage, growing population of Americans with soulless, characterless, invariable jobs that require robot-like humans to do them. I'm reading from the Washington Post. It says, when much of life becomes meaningless, purposeless, and impervious to individual shaping or aspirations, democracy is in deep trouble. The essence of democracy is that the people's will shapes the government and gives us direction to its policy. And when the popular will becomes effective, ineffective, dissipated, irrelevant, or the possession only of a few, then democracy is gravely ill. Now, what's happened to this country, what's happened to the musicians and certain lawyers, attorneys and witnesses to trials, or writers, and all segments of our society that have been corrupted and used for the purpose of political oppression, are the victims of a system that began the end of World War I, and certainly J. Edgar Hoover and his cohorts were a part of that past and a part of the present, particularly the Division 5 of the FBI that has been linked to the political assassinations. I think in the 5.5 years of Dialogue Conspiracy and in my published articles and various lectures, There's one overriding fear which I have had continuously, and that is the emergence of the Fourth Reich. It started by studying the relationships of Lee Harvey Oswald to persons of Nazi ilk, like George de Morenschild, or Marina Oswald's links to the extreme right-wing Nazis that had moved to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I think those political assassinations were well coordinated. I think they were long in the planning. I think they involved and still involve a second secret government known as the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Bureau of Investigations, the FBI, the National Security Agency, the entire intelligence community. I believe the end goal of these murders is fascism, and I believe that the press is very much a part of covering this up and is doing a very successful job of snowballing the mass media in the United States and brainwashing the people in the United States. I don't think there's any hope for Jimmy Carter to prosecute former CIA Director William Helms because of perjury, because William Helms has threatened as early as 1972, that was 5 years ago, that if he's prosecuted for anything, he will tell all the seamy things he did for the White House. And I think under the guise of national security, we can't afford to tell the world not only how we did the murders, but how we covered them up. William Colby, the former CIA director after Richard Helms, he was in power at the height of Watergate, threatened Senator Howard Baker that if the Senate Select Committee made their work appear that the CIA was involved in breaking into the Democratic headquarters in Washington, D.C., June 17, 1972, that Mr. Colby might, in quotes, feel it necessary to take an appropriate public position to assure that the conclusions from my investigations and the results of other investigations are also known. That letter was dated June 28, 1974, and at that point the hearings of the Watergate stopped. There were hardly any more public hearings, and they never got into the matter of the Howard Hughes money or the real motive or the purposes of Watergate. I'm disappointed in the fact that no matter how many researchers there are, how many facts are uncovered, how many autopsy reports we collect, how many pieces of evidence are reported missing and destroyed by the police departments, no matter how many witnesses are murdered, how many connecting links of the assassinations are exposed, I do not believe that the mass media is going to allow you to have this information. The way they're handling it is to start a fall series, a barrage of television shows to reaffirm their interest in the conspiracies and to lay down any fears or controversies, and they will put on these shows with no hard evidence to prove that they are lying, and they have selected material that it was taken without cross-examination or explanation by the Warren Commission to put before the American people. And before the barrage of media begins in the fall showing and begins to brainwash another generation, every 3 or 4 years we get a total barrage of this kind of news. The Dallas News puts out a syndicated story on the press, which is interesting. It says the survey reveals that the people trust television more than any source of information. This is Dallas Morning News, August 17th. And it says the latest in a series of studies made by the Roper Organization since 1959 shows that most Americans like and trust what they see on TV. The survey shows the public continues to regard television as the number one source of news. 64% listed TV as their main source of news. Imagine 64% of the entire United States thinks television is their only source of news at all, and they trust the news on the television as the most believable. Since 1961, this is 2 years before the assassination, the American people have learned to trust that big box that sits in their living room. They don't look at it as an enemy or a foreign object. I look at it as an object that lies to us, that misinforms, that is selectively truthful, that plays with our brains, that interrupts our attention span. But the syndicated story coming out of the Dallas paper says that the Americans regard it as number one. And that in itself is preparing you for the fall series, because television is honest. Everyone trusts it. And what is coming out this winter? Penn Jones from Texas has a newsletter. It's called The Continuing Inquiry, and he's listed some facts about the new fall shows coming out. If you want Penn's newsletter, you can write to me for his address if you don't have it already and subscribe. It's a very good newsletter. And he says about the news media, the perpetuators of assassinations and cover-up misinformation and disinformation have come up with a new technique, the so-called docudrama. This device could more accurately be described as propaganda. These are expensively produced primetime TV productions scripted to perpetuate the myths manufactured by the masters of deceit behind the elaborate cover-ups. Each of the television networks has been given its own cover-up assignment by the misinformation masterminds, anticipating some possible progress in the JFK Martin Luther King investigation being conducted by the House Select Committee. They've instigated the following programs to brainwash the public and counteract any truth that could be revealed by the committee. ABC Television will have the trial of Lee Harvey Oswald using the Warren Report as a script, not the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission hearings. And Penn says Mr. Scavenger, Larry Schiller, will be the producer. It will be certain to have the jury find Lee Harvey Oswald guilty as the lone nut communist assassin. I've heard in advance that actually the finale of the trial of Lee Harvey Oswald is that he has given a supposed trial based on the evidence on the killing of John Kennedy, and the jury is in the room trying to decide whether he's innocent or guilty. And the way the movie ends is that Oswald is shot by Jack Ruby, so you have to come to your own conclusions. I'm telling you in advance what the trial of Lee Harvey Oswald is going to be. But all the evidence submitted in the program will make Lee Harvey Oswald guilty. It's just that the jury won't come back and say it. They want you to do some thinking for yourself. And based upon the evidence that they're going to submit to you, he'll probably look guilty. But if I put on the show, I could submit some other information to you, and he would look innocent. I could prove to you that he never owned a rifle. He never shot a rifle. That he only had, oh yeah, I'm sorry, he shot one in the Marines. I'm talking about in Fort Worth or Dallas or in Mexico or New Orleans when he came to the United States in 1962. He did shoot in the Marines. Another show besides the trial of Lee Harvey Oswald is CBS 4 Days in Dallas. That is going to be a program also titled Ruby, Jack Ruby, and Lee Harvey Oswald. That's not going to go into Jack Ruby's links to the Texas oil people, to Connie Trammell of the CIA, the Republic National Bank, or to the people involved in the CIA that brainwashed Jack Ruby to believe he was a hero. It won't go into those areas at all. It will go into Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald, and filming that in Dallas right now. NBC is going to have a 5-hour drama about civil rights leader Martin Luther King. And if you've been reading the news, there's quite a stir about that. Penn Jones said probably next year we can look forward to propaganda dramas about Teddy's bridge party at Chappaquiddick, Arthur Bremer's parking lot shots at George Wallace, Sirhan Sirhan's amnesia, and Richard Nixon's deep throat infection. That'll be next year. And Penn said, as Joseph Goebbels, Nazi minister of propaganda and enlightenment, said, if you tell a lie big enough and often enough, people will believe it. And we might add, in this modern day of television, with Walter Cronkite voted the most trusted man in America, people are likely to say, it must be true. I saw it on TV. In addition to this TV propaganda coming out soon, we have a book by Marina Oswald with Priscilla Johnson. Priscilla Johnson was in the CIA. This has been confirmed. She was a journalist. She was at the embassy in Moscow when Lee Harvey Oswald was there. She met with Lee Harvey Oswald in Russia. Her family brought Svetlana Stalin to the United States for the CIA. That was a big coup. They stayed at her father's home in Long Island. And Marina Oswald is working with Priscilla on a book. Margaret Oswald has said in the news this past week that she's anxious for Marina's book to come out, and didn't know why it didn't come out earlier. I can't imagine, in my wildest imagination, why Margaret Oswald is anxious for this book. Somebody said to me before we went on the air, maybe she's waiting for a lawsuit that she can make a fortune on by seeing the book and suing the publishers, because Marina Oswald was the single most damaging witness and pathological liar the Warren Commission ever had. She testified before them. First, Lee Harvey Oswald brought a weapon from Russia. And then she changed that story that he didn't. She said he was out of work and unemployed in Dallas-Fort Worth, and that's why these oil engineers, Nazis, had to get him a job at a printing office that worked for the government, and that was not true. He went immediately to work there. He had a job the day he walked in. She had signed Alex Heidel, his signature, that also ordered that famous rifle from Klein's. She used that name for Fair Play for Cuba cards in New Orleans and never came out and admitted that she used that alias of Lee Harvey Oswald until somebody working on the investigation found out that she did, and then she admitted it. She lied about Lee Harvey Oswald's attempts to shoot a General Walker. She lied about Lee Harvey Oswald staying in a bathroom where she held the door and kept him from shooting Richard Nixon. He wasn't even in town at that time. I don't know why Marguerite Oswald wants that book out or why she trusts Priscilla Johnson. Those two women have been so damaging to the person known as Lee Harvey Oswald, who was trained at the Atsugi Air Base in Japan, the home of the U-2, who had top security clearance in the services, who mysteriously came across a lot of money and ended up over in Finland and then into Russia. Just last week in the news, there was an article that Finland helped the CIA get agents into Russia. I don't know why Marguerite wants the book, but she wants to. Also, as I said, the people around Reverend Abernathy and Mrs. Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson are furious at the psychodrama of Martin Luther King. There's a scene in there of King handing a gun to his friend and implying that he did have weapons when it actually could have been the last gun he ever had and decided never to hold a gun again. The visual image of him with this gun is important in the movie. I don't believe goes on to say that he never did ever own a gun. It makes him look like he willingly handed out an arsenal. One of the worst scenes in the movie, which is being made by Abby Mann and the notorious Mark Lane, the attorney Mark Lane, has a scene where J. Edgar Hoover is talking about wiretapping Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy orders the wiretap on King for the purpose of satisfying J. Edgar Hoover, who told him that Martin Luther King was seeing the communists. Now, if Martin Luther King was seeing communists and Robert Kennedy covered it up, he would be accused and his brother of harboring communists and encouraging the communist movement in the United States. So he ordered the wiretaps on Martin Luther King to find out there were communists. But what J. Edgar Hoover did was to take the wiretaps and locate Mr. King in various bedrooms and got all of his sighing and his breathing and his sex scenes and then gave them to Lyndon Johnson, the President of the United States, at night, who invited bedtime pals in, and they'd throw them around for laughter and kicks and fill their sexual delights and their fantasies and their own empty lives listening to Martin Luther King have sex. The fact that Robert Kennedy suggested go ahead and bug him was for political purposes. These were not political women, and he wasn't on political trips, and he wasn't with known communists from out of the country. So if the wiretap was put, it was put for a protective purpose, or they'd be accused of being soft on communism. But the difference between the political contacts and the sexual relaxations will not be delineated in this movie. They were used for perversions of these people in the White House and J. Edgar Hoover and all of their bunnies, and they had a really good time with that. I think it's disgusting that Abby Mann and Mark Lane are getting the wrath of people who are even trying to stop the show, and this is the first TV show I've ever heard of people waking up enough out of their lethargy to want to stop. We've had so many bad shows that this must be really bad that they're organizing back there. And incidentally, Mark Lane has given up shop in Washington, D.C. The committee has another year to go, a year and a half, and another $1.5 million to spend, and he has closed shop on the Kennedy assassination. He got out one book, codenamed Zorro, on Martin Luther King, a quickie book with Dick Gregory, and has now bowed out of the investigation in Washington, D.C. I find that very peculiar. He was going to be the guru, the leader. He had a cult around him that I never trusted. I've talked about them on Dialogue Conspiracy many times. He's in Hollywood now making a controversial movie, and I think it's consistent with the Mark Lane I have talked about, and I hope that some of you who watch his behavior and actions in the future can relate to some of the things I've said in the past and just see where he goes from here. I believe everybody's cover will be blown eventually if it isn't already, and the consistently good researchers keep staying on with the work or write to the congressional committees or hope that something becomes uncovered to fight this massive amount of media assault on the truth. But the media is so controlled that it's depressing to me to see these pictures coming out and to praise themselves as the true historians of America. It depresses me because finding the first links of the Nazis, say, first to George de Morenschild or Lee Harvey Oswald's friends in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and then studying Reinhard Gehlen forming our CIA, who was head of Hitler's intelligence, and being the bulwark of our CIA, and J. Edgar Hoover working with the Nazis, and then seeing the Nazis in power in Chile and in Argentina, and getting ready for a coup in France next April, and having their fingertips on Greece, at least for a short while, 7 years, and that was reversed. But I don't know how many countries can be reversed on time if too many of them go Nazi at one time. We can't keep up with what's happening in our country, and it's hard to keep up with what's happening around the world. There is a gentleman named Willie Brandt who has the same fears of this world Nazism that I have, and there's an article about him Saturday, August the 20th in the Washington Post. You may want to get that. It said, Brandt warns of the rise of Nazism in West Germany. And if it goes in West Germany, it's going to go all of Europe. He said in a letter made public by the ruling Social Democratic Party, former Chancellor Willy Brandt, has warned that his successor, Helmut Schmidt, of a growth of neo-Nazism in West Germany. There are complaints from local party leaders that extreme rightist groups are openly displaying Nazi flags and Nazi insignia, and they are meeting with the full knowledge and approval of local authorities in various towns. Germans are concerned by the spread of ultra-right extremists in West Germany. Much of it is based in groups of World War II veterans and rightist worker groups called Comradeship Federations. A party spokesman said Schmidt ordered an investigation into neo-Nazism. He said many Germans have expressed public sympathy for a dying Nazi war criminal, Herbert Kapler, who recently was taken from an Italian jail into Germany. Brandt had fled to Norway in 1930 to escape the Nazis. He wrote Mr. Schmidt July the 12th that the neo-Nazi groups are openly displaying their symbols and their theories, and that the hatred against minorities is so blatant they're calling for the overthrow of any free democratic order. He cited 320 crimes with extreme rightist motives registered in 1976, an increase of 50% over 1975. The conservative magazine called Quick and a liberal magazine Stern complained about Nazi extremists. They said, we're not talking about a few hundred people who still rave about world conquest. The Munich-based thousands of former soldiers of World War II hold regimental and division reunions. Hitler's shadow is omnipresent. They cited 60 SS reunions in the past 6 months. Mr. Heinz Galinsky, West Berlin Jewish Community Chairman, said there is definitely a revitalization of the radical rightist scene. There's a refusal by a Bavarian town councilman to withdraw an honorary citizenship to a high Nazi official. They named the former Waffen SS officer Hans Weissenbach to the parliament of the Christian Democratic Party. There are new articles, new books, movies about Hitler. They play down atrocities. They exaggerate the achievements of the Third Reich. The nonchalant attitude towards the Nazi era by adult Germans are ignoring the Nazis, but the young people are not being allowed to know, and they're ignoring the truth, and the older people are nonchalant. This is a fear of Willy Brandt, and you know that he was removed from office on a blackmail charge set up with a so-called communist. He's anti-Nazi like Otto John was, and he was removed from office. And Willy Brandt sees the earmark in the amounts of violences and in the reunion of these people at their meetings and the wearing the swastika. The same kind of fear I've expressed on Dialogue Conspiracy in America, that Nazi units in Oregon, Los Angeles, and Florida are carrying cards, wearing armbands, having meetings, and the Mexican-Americans have become a target of the Nazis as well as the blacks. There's a resurgence and a heavily financed movement that will not go away. It will not go away if there's apathy. And the big problem, I wonder, is if the apathy comes from any kind of chemicals in the food or in our beverages or in the media alone. Can people rally enough strength to fight this from the inside, to fight people like J. Edgar Hoover, or expose the links, say, Richard Nixon to the Nazis, or the Hughes Organization to the Nazis. I don't think they can. There's a good book that came out, The Mormon Brotherhood, by Bill Stevenson, and it was immediately suppressed. His book, Intrepid, has been getting a lot of play. The Mormon Brotherhood was suppressed. Project Paperclip is never on the stands. It's hard to buy. The books about World War II and the Nazis, even the Howard Bloom book, The Search for the Nazis in America, was stopped. It was published by the New York Times, and he was on a few radio television shows around the country. And the whole thing is hushed up, and nobody wants to go into his facts. The Nazification of South Africa in 1948 was just brought out this last week in August, by the heart transplant surgeon, Mr. Christian Barnard. He has an article, this is a Wire Service Associated Press, saying that South Africa made a mistake in 1948. See, that's the year that World War II was over, the Nazis were coming into this country and all over the world. He said, the ruling Nationalist Party came to power to unscramble the egg by instituting political and social separation of the races. It was a critical period in the history of the human race. It was just after World War II, and the stench of Nazi concentration camps was still in our nostrils. Yet we come along and talk about the purity of South Africa, the white South Africa. It is no wonder we're called Nazis, that we're called fascists. This is the impression we give the world. He said, South Africa made a mistake to implement racial separation in an arrogant and ignorant way. We now broadcast our approach to doom by putting it in the law books. We have unleashed an anti-white South African campaign by the mass media abroad that has no parallel. All whites now become oppressors and all blacks are oppressed. South Africa has become the scum of the world community. Nobody wants to have anything to do with this. And he says it stemmed in 1948 by bringing the Nazis to his country, and that's why they're called fascists. Well, this wasn't a very happy show. This is beginning and ending with Nazis, and they are in the news, but I thought we'd get caught up on a few of these items on Dialogue Conspiracy. And next week we'll go at length into something very happy, the mind and brain experimentation of our agencies that we haven't had on the program before. I hope you can handle it. It's pretty depressing, but that's the way Dialogue Conspiracy is. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California, and I'll see you next week.
There is a truth, I thought to myself, while driving down Route 68. The car in front is a Renault. It's not behind, it's not a Ford. There is a truth, how things happen. If it was yesterday, it wasn't 1894. And if tomorrow not a two come true, there'll be another truth in store. And those who think there is no truth, that all depends on point of view, will lock us up, fire the bomb, made only for a gentleman to use. The president is just a choice, he should not claim his fame. One November night, I heard the screaming horns. A new America had changed her name. We're not the same, you and I are not. And you who call free thinkers enemies, you are clearly now the enemies. And we will do what we must do to keep it free, like I must write, and she must sing, and they must slave. You must have heard that we will never really rise again. The minds behind the plastic mules gave the word. They cannot just mow us down. It's they who are the arch-anemic ones. Ours are free and tender girls. Ours are mountain-climbing sons.